Well, we've been talking communication for several months now, and mostly using Paul Tripp's book, War of Words, and we're not going to actually finish his book because we've gotten sidetracked a little bit. There's a couple chapters left. If you have a chance, you maybe would pick up that book. It's a great book. But we just have 2 weeks left before we take our summer break, and then we'll figure out this summer what we do next year. But we've been talking communication, and we've gotten a little sidetracked, and we've zoned in on one particular form of communication that's very common and that causes all kinds of problems, and that's the problem of gossip. So we've been talking gossip. I was reading a quote from Charles Spurgeon this afternoon about gossip. He is here talking about listening to gossip, actually. And he says, he is a fool, if not a dishonest man, who picks up stolen goods and harbors them. In slander as well as robbery, the receiver is as bad as the thief. So if you pick up stolen goods and you know they're stolen and you keep them, even though you didn't steal them yourself, you're as bad as the thief. And he says that's true for the person who hears gossip. He's sinning just as much as the person who gives it. If there were not gratified hearers of ill reports, there would be an end of the trade of spreading them. One Puritan says, the talebearer carrieth the devil in his tongue, and the talehearer carries the devil in his ear. The talebearer carries the devil in his tongue. The talehearer carries the devil in his ear. It's a sin to endure or tolerate talebearers, gossips. Show that man out, we should say of a drunkard. Yet it's very questionable if his unmanly behavior will do us so much mischief as the gossip's insinuating story. So if there was a drunk, obviously, in our environment, and he was just kind of being silly, we'd be like, let's get this drunk out of here. But his behavior is probably not going to be as damaging as the gossip's. Call for a policeman, we say, if we see a thief at his business. Ought we to feel no indignation when we hear a gossip at her work? Mad dog is a terrible cry, but there are few dogs whose bite is so dangerous as a gossip's tongue. Fire, fire is an alarming note, but the gossip's tongue is set on fire of hell, and those who indulge it had better mend their manners, or they may find that there is fire in hell for unbridled tongues. Our Lord spoke evil of no man, but breathed a prayer for his foes. We must be like him, or we shall never be with him. Spurgeon, wow. So we've been talking about this sin of gossip, what it is, why it's a problem. And then the last time we were together, we talked a little bit about Ephesians 4. And thought about how to change and this whole process of putting off and putting on. So if we're going to overcome gossip, what do we need to do? We need to identify what it is, and then we need to put it off, and we need to put on something in its place. And I want to think a little more tonight about what we need to put on. So what do we need to put on instead of gossip? Why is that an important question to ask? What do we need to put on instead of gossip? Why might that be something important for us to think about? That's right. Yeah, you're not someone different until you are. Your heart is different and you're doing something different. But is there any way, maybe to say it this way, is there any way that gossip is the wrong way of doing something right? So many sins are perversions of something good. So sexual sin is a perversion. It's not just that, I mean, sex is for something good. Drunkenness is overdosing on pleasure. So the drunk gets something right in a sense, like God designed things for our pleasure, but he gets it wrong because he overdoses on it. There's lots of examples of how something that we're doing wrong, actually the root of it, might have something right. How might gossip be like that? How might gossip be a wrong way of doing something right? What are you doing when you gossip, if we break it apart? What's the first thing that besides pride and all that stuff, but what's the thing that instigates the desire to gossip? Maybe the looking at it from the best possible angle. Okay, yeah, we're evaluating what somebody else is doing, and we see that it's a problem. We think that it's a problem. And then we talk to someone about it. That's basically gossip. Gossip is seeing something you perceive as a problem that you think is negative in someone else. You have evaluated it. This is not the right thing to do. And then you talk to someone about it. What in there is okay? It's okay to perceive a problem. It's okay to evaluate. It's okay to come to a conclusion. And it's okay to talk to someone. But what does gossip get wrong? The first thing gossip gets wrong is it takes up the role of judge. So it's not just perceiving a problem. It's feeling like you get to be the judge of someone else. And that was when we saw in James 4:11. Then gossip acts like you are the law. So a lot of times what people are gossiping about isn't actually sin. It's often ignoring God's law and elevating your own law. It's got the wrong motive, so you're not wanting to help the other person. There's no love in gossip. And then it talks to the wrong person and in the wrong way. It talks doesn't go to the person, and it goes behind their back. So gossip gets a lot of things wrong. It's a perversion, because perverting is taking something right and twisting it into something weird. But the fact that gossip gets all those things wrong means we need to go back and think more about the right response in those situations. So we don't want to just stop gossiping. That's the wrong way of doing something. But what's the right way of doing that thing? So if you perceive that someone is doing something you think is wrong, what do you need to do instead of gossip? What are our other options from the Bible? What would be some other options if you perceive something that you think, yeah, this person's not in error? Okay, we'll come to that one at the very end. Pray about it. Pray, for sure. James 4, when he talks about why we have fights and quarrels with one another, he says, you have fights and quarrels because you're not praying, basically. And then he says, when you do pray, you've got selfish desires, even in the way that you talk to God. But so we see something that we think is wrong in someone else. Certainly, one of the first things we should do is pray. What else should we do? What else could we do? Yeah, that's Matthew 7, and we'll come to that one as well. A good thing to do when you are tempted to gossip about somebody else or you perceive a problem and you want to talk about it is evaluate yourself, sort of use that as a stop sign, evaluate yourself and ask, why does it bother me so much? That was a great question my dad always used to ask me when I would complain about somebody else. He'd say, but why does it bother you? And then I would say, because of what they're doing. And he would say, no, but why does it bother you? And then I'd say, because of what they're doing. He'd say, no, but why does it bother you? And then I'd say, because I'm proud or something like that. But it was good. It was helpful because I realized they were really, my parents were always really tough when I would blame someone else for my sin. They would be really careful about their language or my language. They would say, no, Josh, that's not quite accurate. They are putting you in a situation where it's more tempting for you to sin. It's more tempting for you to respond that way. But they're not forcing you. It's not their fault that you are doing this. What they're doing is putting pressure on you, which is revealing what is in your heart. And that could be annoying, but it was helpful because I realized, whoa, I need to ask when I perceive a problem in somebody else, a really great question is, why does that bother me so much? Not because a lot of times we'll say, it bothers me because it's sin. And then first of all, we should ask ourselves, but where do I see that it's sin? Actually, in the Bible. And sometimes we stop there, we realize, I can't find a Bible verse. I can't put my finger on a Bible verse. All I can put my finger on is That's not how I do it. So that slows us down. Other times we evaluate ourselves and we realize, we stop and we're like, why does it bother me so much? I can't find a Bible verse, or I'm seeing in them something that I actually struggle with. So when somebody's doing something wrong that bothers us, it's the question to ask is not just what does it reveal to us about them, but what does the way I'm responding reveal about me? And sometimes, a lot of times, we can see the things we think we see in others are actually a reflection of our own, the way we are. So we're saying less about them because we don't really know everything about them, but we're saying more about what we would mean if we were in that situation and doing what they're doing. But then what's another option? So pray, evaluate ourselves. Why does it bother me? What's another thing when you perceive somebody doing something wrong? We're going to get to Martyrs here in a second, but there's another option the Bible gives us. Overlook. Whew. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 12. Did I write that down? Is that on the notes? You're just that good. Goodness. No, my word. What am I going to say next? Proverbs 10, 12. Someone want to read Proverbs 10, 12 for us?
Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses.
Okay, so that Proverbs works by parallelism. So the first line and the second line are in some way parallel. Hatred and love are opposites. Hatred stirs up strife. How? By uncovering offenses. And love seeks peace by covering offenses. Proverbs 19, verse 6 says something similar. Oh, no, that's the wrong verse. Well, it is similar to Proverbs 10, 12. We can go to 1 Peter 4, 8. That definitely says something similar. This is why I usually write all the verses down when I... 1 Peter 4, 8. Someone want to read 1 Peter 4, 8 for us?
Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins.
So what does love seek to do there? Same thing as we read in Proverbs. Love wants to cover a multitude of sins. What do you think about that when you hear that? Love wants to cover a multitude of sins. What questions come to your mind or thoughts come to your mind? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. What could be right about that and wrong about that? But when do you overlook? Do you have any sort of policy in your own mind as like a flow, like when do I overlook, when do I not overlook? Because it is saying that love wants to cover, but it can't be that love always just sort of covers, because that's not actually loving to always cover, is it? Yeah.
And you may be one of those others. But,
yeah, so you said a few things there,
yeah.
Right? So one question would be, is this actually a sin, or is it just a preference? When would you speak to somebody about a preference? Is there ever a time... is there ever a time to speak to somebody about a preference? A lot of times we speak about preferences way before we speak about sin, which I think is kind of sad. We're a lot faster. If you look, notice, not all of us, we're, you know, you're like, hey, not me, but just use we're like this. But it's tempting to get more fired up when it's a preference than when it's actually not bothering you, but it is a sin. So I think that sometimes says something about us. But it's something to think about. When would I talk to somebody about a preference? Some people have really, this is something that you want to, Jay Adams used to talk about having very small toes. Some people have super big, Jay Adams was a biblical counselor. Some people have super big toes. You can step on their feet from like a mile away. Like you don't even have to be in this room and you can step on their feet. Their toes are so big. But you want to be a person who has really small toes. Like it is so hard to step on your feet. So hard to offend you. But there may be an occasion where you need to talk to somebody about a preference. And maybe one of the times would be when you are living in close proximity and it's really become a struggle for you and it's impacting the relationship in some way. But then when you do talk to them about a preference, you want to make sure that you're not talking about it in the same way you would talk about a sin, and that actually you're talking about it more primarily about your, something's wrong with you, like, or at least something weird about you. This is a preference. I should be able to not be bothered by it. For some reason, I'm weird, and it just keeps getting in my head when you are, walking around with untied shoelaces or something. This is really getting in my head. Could you help me by trying to think of that? So that might be something you need to do with a preference every once in a while, very rarely, hopefully. But we'd really be helped with a lot of self-control. But sometimes it takes a lot of self-control, doesn't it? It is amazing. I was thinking the other day, I was in a situation, and it was about 20 minutes where I was noticing something that I thought was annoying. And I couldn't believe how hard it was for me not to say something. And I didn't say something, but I was like, wow, I am so broken that this person right here is doing something that's not even close to sin. Like, it's not even, I can't even find a way to think that that would be sin. And yet, I can't look at it because it's for some reason annoying me so much. I have to be really self-controlled because that's not something I should put on them. That's something that's mine. I'm the one who's messed up there. And I need to pray, Lord, please help me be kinder and more loving to this person. But love does confront. One, is it sin? Wow, I'm getting off track. Is it sin? And then two, is it a pattern of sin? Or is it something that's so out of character, they don't really need me to say anything about it because I've never seen that in them before. I've never seen that in them after. Is it something that I can trust the Lord is going to convict them about? Is it something that is impacting their relationship with somebody else? And is it something that's impacting their relationship with me? Those would be some questions you would ask. So you can overlook. There are times to overlook, for sure. And then what are your other options instead of gossiping? But if you're going to overlook, then you have to overlook it, by the way, not just with them, but with everybody. You know, like you can't overlook it with, say you're overlooking it, and then go talk about it with everybody else. That's not overlooking. That's gossiping. That's being weak and cowardly. So if you're going to overlook, you have to overlook and choose to love. Or you can correct. You can go seek to confront and correct. And that last one is amazingly hard. Gossip's a lot easier. For some reason, talking to someone else about someone else's sin is a lot easier than talking to the actual person about their sin, which, again, is sad and perverted, really. But that's probably why we don't like to do it, because it's hard for most of us. Instead of gossiping, we need to learn to go to someone and correct them in the right manner. And I want us to think about how we're to do that over the next 2 weeks, because it is really hard for a lot of us. What are some things that make going to someone and correcting them difficult for you? If it's easy for you, you can just sit this question out. But what are some things that make going to someone and correcting someone difficult for you? What's that?
Like, can't control it. Their feelings might be hurt by it.
Okay.
It might be awkward.
Yeah. there's really some kind people out there that are worried about the other person's feelings. That's neat. But yeah, so they worry that they might feel badly. There are others that are less worried about that, but they're more worried about my own feelings, that they're not going to like me after I correct them. I know there really are people like that, and I think they're so neat. I'm usually more worried about, I don't like that they're going to be bothered by me. Or, did somebody else have one? Right. Yeah, this is a great K-drama line. That guy's so nosy, they always say. I noticed that they say that a lot in K-dramas, but it's true. It's not my business. They're living their life. I'm living my life. I don't want to get involved in what's going on in their life. Or they're going to think, what's this guy talking to me about this for?
You're like afraid of conflict.
Yes.
Being a conflict with the person.
Yes. It's funny how afraid of conflict we can be, you know, but it's definitely true. It's neat to sit back and think, what is so scary about conflict? But for some reason, it does seem scary a lot of times. Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we are conscious of how sinful we are. So that can kind of make us gun shy going to someone else.
That's right. Who am I? Yeah, or if I go correct them, now they're going to want to correct me. And so why don't we just keep it nice? I won't correct you, you don't correct me, and we both live our lives and kind of ignore each other's sins. I think another thing that can make it difficult is that you're not always right. And you know that, like, that you're not always right. I wonder, have you ever been in a situation where you thought someone was in the wrong only to find out later that you had misread the situation? Anybody have an example of that? There definitely, I can't think of one off the top of my head right now, but there definitely have been times where I was sure that I understood what was going on and found out later I really was wrong, like big time wrong about the situation. So that can make us a little slow to go to correct. But just because sometimes we're wrong when we evaluate what's going on doesn't mean we should never evaluate what other people are doing or have an opinion about it. So let's look at a few passages to make clear that we actually do need to evaluate. 1 Kings chapter 3, 6 through 9. So we'll just look at a couple of these passages real quickly. 1 Kings 3, 6 through 9. And this is probably the less direct one. This is 1 Kings is a narrative. This is a story about Solomon. You know the story. Solomon is basically, God's come to him and said, ask what you want and I'll give it to you. And Solomon says, you've been so kind to my father and I get to sit on the throne now. And he says in verse 7, now, O Lord, my God, you've made your servant king in place of David, my father. Although I'm but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servants in the midst of your people, whom you've chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this, your great people? So Solomon's a king, and that means he's in a unique position. But he prays that he might be able to evaluate what is good and what is evil in other people's lives, which means at the very least that it must not always be wrong to do that. There must be times and situations where it's totally appropriate for someone to evaluate what's good and what's evil in another person's life. And Hebrews chapter 5, verse 14, makes clear that this is one of the marks, actually, of someone who's spiritually mature. They're able to discern between good and evil. In the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 5, verse 14, he says, solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. So mature people here are people who have the ability to evaluate, yes, that's good, no, that's not. Matthew 7, verse 6. We're going to look at Matthew 7 quite a few times tonight, so you might want to just put something there. But Matthew 7, verse 6 is a famous passage about judging. Matthew 7, Jesus says, judge not. But right after Jesus says, judge not, you know what he says? He says, do not give dogs what's holy. And he's not talking about actual dogs there. He's talking about people. And so he says, you have to know who is a dog. And that's a negative judgment, actually. You know, it's not a compliment to call somebody a dog. He's saying you have to be able to know who's a dog, obviously, if you're not going to give them what's holy. Don't give dogs what's holy. So you have to know that person's a dog, so I can't give them what's holy. That's making a judgment about somebody. That's evaluating. Matthew 7:15, he says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. So that's some skill. Inwardly they're ravenous wolves, but on the outside, what do they look like? Sheep. So that takes a lot of skill. You have to be able to identify. Somebody looks a certain way on the outside, but you have to be able to identify that they're different on the inside. That otherwise, you're not going to be able to be aware of them, right? So we definitely have to make evaluations. When we say we need to put off gossip, we're not saying never make any evaluations of anybody ever again. We have to be able to make evaluations about what's good and what's evil, but there is danger. We have to be aware of the danger in making these evaluations. And what are some of the dangers? We have to make evaluations, but what are some of the dangers in making evaluations of other people? We're all constantly doing it, but what are some of the dangers we face in doing that? So I would be surprised if there's one person here tonight who has gone through the day without making an evaluation of someone else and what they said or what they did, even how they drove. You know, like, we're constantly making evaluations of other people. There's a place for that, but what dangers do we face if that's what we constantly are doing? One is from James. You remember James, where he talks about don't speak evil, don't judge your brother, don't set yourself up as judge over someone else. So a lot of times when we're making evaluations, the danger for us is that we start to think we're God. And that's really dangerous. Matthew 7 shows us another one of the dangers. Matthew 7, 1 through 6. Let's read this one together. So you might want to turn there. Matthew 7, 1 through 6. Says, judge not that you be not judged. So what's the command there?
Don't judge.
Pretty simple. How do many people interpret this verse?
Don't ever say anything that anyone does wrong.
Yeah, don't ever make an evaluation. Don't ever say anything that somebody's done is wrong. How do we know that's not what Jesus means? Well, we've just kind of said it. It would be impossible, right? We're called to discern what's good, what's evil. That's a biblical command as well. So it can't mean don't ever make an evaluation. Don't ever say that what somebody else has done is wrong from the Bible. But also just from life, it would be impossible. Imagine like a teacher, the kid turns in their homework and the teacher like marks it up with the red pen and the kid comes back and says, you're so unbiblical. You know, Jesus says, judge not, or you'll be judged. The teacher has to be able to make an evaluation and a critical evaluation there. R.C. Sproul tells a story. When he was a young pastor, there was a mother in his church who asked if he could speak to her son, and the son was an adult, but this mom was upset with something he did, and she wanted R.C. Sproul to speak with him. And when R.C. met with him, the young man was angry, and so R.C. asked him what he was so angry about, and the man said, I'm angry at my mom. I'm so angry at my mom. She's always trying to push religion in my face. And I just want her to leave me alone. And so R.C. said, okay, that's interesting. Tell me a little bit about your view of life. How do you think people should live their lives? And he said, I just think we should let people do whatever they want to do. Let them live their life their way. And then R.C. looked at him and he said, if you really believe that, then I don't know why you're so mad at your mom. If that's the way she wants to live, she wants to push religion in your face, then why don't you just let her do what she wants to do? And of course, R.C. was teasing him, but he wanted him to see that even saying don't judge is a judgment. When somebody goes to you, don't judge, you're talking about sin or something, they say to you, don't judge, what are they doing? They're judging you. They're saying you're wrong because you're judging. So whatever Jesus means when he says don't judge, he can't mean you're never allowed to look at someone's behavior, make a discernment, and recognize it as wrong. But what does he mean? He's commanded us not to do something. What's the essence of what he's saying? I think what he means is that there's a wrong way to respond to the differences we see in others, and that's by becoming a hard, critical, mean person, if you want to put it in simple ways, a simple way. We as Christians have to avoid spiteful criticism. So we need to make evaluations, but the danger as we make those evaluations is that we might think we're God, or that we might start becoming this person who's just so hard and makes these really becomes very critical. John MacArthur, I think I gave you in your notes John MacArthur's explanation on this. Let me read it and we can just comment on it. He says, all throughout the Bible, we're commanded to discern, to try the spirits, to have our senses exercised, to know the difference between good and evil. That's Hebrews 5:14. Now, having said that, we look at judge not. We know it doesn't mean that we're not to discriminate between truth and error. I mean, that's infantile. It's a child, according to Ephesians 4, that doesn't know the difference between good and evil, that becomes victimized and prey to Satan's cunning craftiness because of an inability to discern. We must discern. We must discriminate. We must evaluate. There are things we must judge. That's not what the Lord's talking about. What is he talking about? What he's talking about is the critical, judgmental, condemning, self-righteous egotism of the Pharisees. They weren't criticizing people because of sin. They were criticizing them because of their personality, their character, their weaknesses, their frailties, perhaps the way they looked or the way they dressed or the fact that they didn't do things the way they did them. They were criticizing their motives, which they couldn't see or perceive anyway in their humanness. You don't know why a person does what he does. To go around saying, well, we should love everybody and never judge anybody, that isn't what the Lord is saying. In fact, in Leviticus 19, it says this, thou shalt not hate thy brother. Thou shalt not hate thy brother. What do you mean? Thou shalt in any case rebuke thy neighbor and not allow sin on him. In other words, to allow him to sin is to hate him, not to love him. So if you see, sin is love that makes a change. Well, I'm not sure what that line means there, but it is love that demands repentance. So if you see sin, love demands repentance. Okay, maybe that's what he means. People say, I don't want to say anything. We just love everybody. No, when you find sin and you tolerate it, you're hating your brother, not loving him. It's love that confronts. It's hate that ignores a fault and a sin and lets a person go in that path. Jesus expressed evaluation. He condemned repeatedly. He judged. He evaluated. He criticized. He unmasked and stripped naked the Pharisees in Matthew 23. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the ugly, self-righteous, judgmental, critical spirit of the Pharisees. Not only the Pharisees, but a lot of other folks had the same problem, and we fight it as well even today. We're not shirking church discipline, but we're talking about that personal, critical spirit. So if you want an easy translation of what it says in Matthew 7:1, it says, stop criticizing, stop criticizing. Who are you to criticize other people? That's the issue. We must judge. We must evaluate. Romans 16 says that we need to mark those that cause divisions and avoid them. We must make doctrinal distinctions. We must mark the people who offend that doctrine. We must avoid these people. We can't all get together. We must make distinctions. And that judgment must begin at the, Peter says, at the house of God. We have a right to judge righteous judgment, John 7:24, but not the carping criticism of the Pharisees. And that's essentially what he's saying. And one way we know that Jesus is saying that is, and that's what he means, is because he gives an illustration in Matthew 7:3. He says, why do you see the speck that's in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log in your own eye? And that's what he's talking about. And what's a log? A log is that huge beam they would use in a house, like massive beam. And it's in a person's eye. And yet they're not worried about that because they're looking at this piece of dust in someone else's eye instead. That's, if you think about that, that is like almost a superpower. To have a tree in your eye and be able to see a piece of dust in somebody else's eye. And yet, you know, it's not very super because all of us have that power. That's what we're really good at. And that's judging, being able to spot a small little piece of dust and feel like it's huger than the tree that's in your eye. There's another passage where Jesus talks about this that helps. It's over in Luke chapter 6, verse 37. And so you can just turn there or listen to this. But Luke 6, 37 says, "Judge not, and you will not be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you." And so when he says, judge not, and you will not be judged, condemn not, that's not something different than judging. Judging is condemning. It's not forgiving. It's making a big deal out of other people's sins, acting like you're their judge, you're their jury, you're their executioner. There's no listening. There's no wanting them to be right. Just telling them they're wrong. That's the danger. That's the danger. We have to make evaluations, but we can really get off track, and we need to be careful. Like, we don't want to gossip. We need to correct. But as we go to correct, we need to be careful that we don't become so critical in our correcting. And because that tendency to become critical is a massive problem. It's a massive problem. And so, and there are lots of examples of the danger of being critical in the Bible. I actually wrote down a bunch. Joshua 22, do you see that passage there? That's where Israel, there's a couple tribes that are across the river, and they make an altar or something like that, and the 10 tribes see it, and they're like, I can't believe that they're already leaving God, because that's what they thought was going to happen, and they were about to go to war with them over it, and then those couple tribes are like, no, we actually did this to remember that God's our God. 1 Samuel chapter 1, the story with Eli, Hannah comes in to pray, and he's evaluating her, and he's like, this lady's drunk. And she's actually praying and is going to be used by God to be the one who basically rescues Israel. David goes up. You remember David goes up and to bring his brothers food. And he sees that everybody's so scared of Goliath. And he's going around saying, what can be done about this? And his brother Eliab's like, oh, you're so proud. I can't believe how proud you are. You just like to fight. Matthew chapter 12, the Pharisees. They say Jesus is of the devil. They're evaluating. So there's lots of examples in the Bible of the danger of evaluating critically and wrong. What are some ways that you have struggled with making critical judgments? Is this something that you can see in your life that you've struggled with over the years? What are some ways? What are some things you've learned about not being critical, or some ways that you think about that? I think I've told you one of the things that really helps me is when my dad used to say, when I would be critical, he'd say, Josh, wouldn't it be great if the whole world were just like you? And so that rings in my head all the time when I start to be critical of others. And it really makes me stop and ask, is that really what I'm doing here? Or am I making a good evaluation? Or am I actually just a little bit bothered that not everybody is exactly like me? But what are some other ways that you've had to think through being critical? Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's so tempting, and it's a good warning, too. Like, we have to make sure that we deal with it right, because it is true. Sometimes it's like over the edge, and then that person can't ever get back in. I mean, unless we really repent and the Lord does something amazing. But sometimes we've become so critical and preach to ourselves, in a sense, critical comments about that person without dealing with it correctly, to the point where our interpretation is locked in and they can't, it's really hard for them to ever do anything to change that. You know, if you're a person who has a lot of opinions about a lot of things, you probably want to think about this. Some guys have other issues in their life, and you got to be like, hey, be a little more critical. Like, you got to have some passion to get things right here. Some guys seem like they can put up with. I told you about my friend in Africa who was telling me about, like, one time he was in the grocery store and he said, yeah, the guy hit me, the grocery cart hit me in the heel for the sixth time, and I finally turned around and I was like, hey man, and it was my buddy. And I was like, the sixth time, you know, the first, I would, somebody hit you in the heel with a grocery cart, that's painful. He was just so laid back. That was just totally his style, that like it took six times for him to actually think that maybe I should turn around and see what's going on here. So some people are like that. But others of us are like, we have opinions about everything. Like, I mean, which way the toilet paper should be, toothpaste, the way that it's rolled up. I mean, it sometimes is stunning how many different opinions people can have. Where the remote control should be. So if you're the kind of person who has all those opinions, you probably have to think about this a little bit. And how have some of you thought about this? Also, sometimes if you've been trained, we can be mentored in being critical. So we might have grown up in families where this was just such a common way of speaking that we don't even realize that this is what we're doing. Like, we're just constantly critical, and it doesn't seem like that we would, might not even notice it. But like, what are some ways that you have caught yourself being too critical, or some things that like a little smoke alarm goes on in your mind, you're like whoop 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 whoop, or some ways that you're like, no, actually, I'm not being critical. This is right. Yes. Yes. Oh no! So it's not wrong for a person to have opinions, even about toilet paper. People can have lots of different opinions. Sometimes it's not even wrong for us to say in our families, "Hey, you know, I'm the dad. This is the Lord. The Lord's put me in this position as the father." I kind of did buy this TV, so I know that maybe it's easy for you to just throw the remote control wherever you want to, but it would help me if we just put the remote control in this location. I don't think that's being critical. Now, if you go to somebody else's house, and you're like, oh, I can't believe that they put the remote control there. What kind of person would let the remote control be on there, right there? That person must not be a good steward of their finances. They must be lazy. You know, then you're starting to move into being critical. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's just, I was meaning more like, if I'm a person who has a lot of opinions, then I probably have to watch myself, because I probably have good reasons for a lot of those opinions. But I would think that I would just have to watch myself, that I don't become judging everybody else that does things differently than me. Guys that don't have many opinions, they don't notice where the remote control is, you know? But guys that are a little more careful, they've thought about stuff, I think they may sometimes have more of a temptation to be like, why is this guy not thinking of this? You know, like, he's, because you've thought about it, and it's a better way to do it. Is that making sense, what I'm saying? The guy who has less opinions, he's got his own particular temptations, and I'm sure he can probably tend to be critical of the guy with more opinions. He's like, why does this guy have so many opinions about everything? You know, can't he just have a good life, you know? So he's got to watch out that he's not. We all are proud, so we can find our own ways to be make wrong evaluations of others. So we need to make evaluations. We need to watch out that we don't become harsh. We want to be charitable. That's, I think, what we need to make evaluations. There may be better ways to do things. We may need to talk to somebody about something, But we just want to learn to be charitable in the way that we talk to other people and think about other people. Ken Sandy explains, instead of judging others critically, God commands us to judge charitably. The church has used the word charitable as a synonym for loving. This has resulted in the expression charitable judgments. Making a charitable judgment means that out of love for God, you strive to believe the best about others until you have the facts to prove otherwise. In other words, if you can reasonably interpret facts in two possible ways, God calls you to embrace the positive interpretation over the negative, or at least to postpone making any judgment at all until you can acquire conclusive facts. So we need to make evaluations. We want to avoid becoming just critical judges. We want to replace that with trying to be charitable. And that means trying to believe the best, really. And this is actually really important to become the kind of person who is trying your best to believe what's best about others for a lot of different reasons. Matthew 7 tells us one of them, and Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. And then he says, why do you see the speck that's in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log that's in your own eye? So I want to become a charitable person, because if I'm constantly able to spot the speck in other people's eyes, it's really foolish, because it's going to make it hard for me to help them, because I've got probably a log in my own eye. Matthew 7:12, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. And so being critical is not how we would want to be treated. I was saying to my kids the other day that, like, it's really easy to judge other people on how they act and judge yourself on your intentions. So, like, when I don't do something, I'm like, oh, well, it's not that big a deal because I wanted to do the right thing. I tried to do the right thing. Or I maybe didn't give sacrificially, but I wanted to give sacrificially. And then if somebody else does something, you don't always judge them on their intentions. You actually judge them on their actions. They didn't give. They're messed up. So we tend to be soft on ourselves. Even people who think they're hard on themselves usually are pretty soft on themselves, actually. They're sometimes hard on themselves about preferences or just being human, and soft on themselves about sin. But so being critical, we want to be charitable because it's how we would want to be treated. But also because 1 Corinthians chapter 13 tells us that the nature of love is to believe the best. So Paul defines love in 1 Corinthians 13, and he says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And so love wants to believe the best about others and is hoping the best about others. Ken Sandy explains, he says, the call to judge others charitably is not something new. It finds its roots in the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 2016, God says, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. The church has interpreted this commandment not only to forbid lying, but also to require charitable judgments. Luther's Small Catechism teaches that this commandment means we should fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbor, betray him, slander him, or hurt his reputation, but defend him, speak well of him, and explain everything in the kindest way. So we have to judge charitably, seek to believe the best about others. But does that mean that we just ignore everything? What does believing the best mean and not mean? Like, are we supposed to evaluate others like sort of like Pollyanna? Just like they're punching us in the face and we're like, well, they probably mean like, that's probably they're trying to hug me or something. You know, like whacking you. What does it mean to believe the best and judge charitably in real life? It's not about lying, right? So it can't be a lying and saying something that's not true. I remember there was a guy in South Africa. His name was Oscar Pistorius. He was a, they called him the Blade Runner. So he had those special blades to run. And, well, that's why they call him Blade Runner. Deep, huh? But he was an Olympian, all of these things, Paralympics. And he shot his girlfriend. And it was, I mean, pretty clear that he just murdered her. And I remember we were with one of my friend's moms, and we were all sitting there talking, and she's like, but, what did she say, honey? But I think he's really probably a good person. Deep down, I'm like, wow, you know, your bar for a good person is pretty low. Like, we just found out he murdered his girlfriend. So, you know, that's not, believing the best is not lying. Like, somebody murders somebody, we're like, but deep down, I think probably he just is really a nice guy. What were you going to say? That's right, yeah. It's good when you're starting to speak. It's good when you're starting to think about somebody negatively to say it out loud to yourself at least, and then to evaluate, but do I even know that's true? And then to put off, like, things that are lies. That's why it says don't bear false witness. Don't bear false witness to yourself about somebody else. Like, don't lie to yourself about somebody else by saying things that you don't know actually are true. Instead, seek to believe the best by assuming good motives. I think believing the best also it means that you know that you're a sinner. You know that you're limited in your understanding, and you love the other person, and you want them to be right. Judging charitably does not mean, I think this is Ken Sandy, he says, doesn't mean you have to believe an action's good when there's significant evidence to the contrary. It doesn't mean you have to accept without question everything that people tell you. It does not mean you're not allowed to discuss or debate something. And it doesn't mean you can't apply church discipline. Sometimes we're really tough on others, like we go to correct them and they try to tell us we're wrong, or they try to tell us a different perspective, and we're like, you're being defensive. And maybe they're being defensive, but maybe we're just being a jerk there, because it's so hard. Like, if you have made an evaluation of someone and they're not allowed to give you a different perspective without being called defensive, that's pretty tough, you know? And they might be being defensive, of course, and they need to watch out for that. But believing the best or judging charitably doesn't mean that you're not allowed to have a discussion. It doesn't mean you can't apply church discipline. So if we have to evaluate, we need to evaluate charitably. How can we identify if we're going in the wrong direction? Here are a couple suggestions from Ken Sandy. He says, first, when you think negatively of the qualities of others, when you develop a critical spirit, you start a subtle but steady process of selective data gathering. You easily overlook or minimize others' good qualities, while at the same time search and magnify unfavorable qualities. As you find faults that reinforce opinions you have already formed, you seize them eagerly, saying to yourself, "See, I told you so." One critical judgment looks for and feeds on another, and the person's character is steadily diminished and ultimately destroyed. Second, when you think the worst of their words and actions, you hear rumors of conversations or observe fragments of an opponent's behavior, instead of searching for a favorable interpretation of their actions or giving them a chance to explain, you prefer to put the worst construction on what they've done. You overlook things that are in the person's favor and focus on the things that seem to be against him. To top it off, you fill in the gaps with assumptions and finally judge the person to have done wrong. He tells a story. One day, a small church was expecting a guest preacher. He arrived earlier, sat in his car. He was writing out these thoughts. He would put his short white pencil in his mouth so he could have a free hand to turn to a verse in his Bible. A deacon pulled in beside him, watched him for a moment, went inside. When he walked into the church a few minutes later, he sensed antagonism from the entire group of deacons. He asked if he had done something wrong. The head deacon replied, "We find it very offensive that you would sit in our church parking lot smoking a cigarette, especially when you are about to preach God's word from our pulpit." You can imagine the deacon's embarrassment when the man pulled the pencil from his pocket and explained he had been working on his sermon. So third, when we assume the worst about others' motives, some people are habitually cynical. Others assume the worst only in certain people. In either case, the effect is the same. They're quick to attribute others' actions to an unworthy motive, such as pride, greed, selfishness, control, rebellion, stubbornness. When doing this, they think or say things like, "All he cares about is money. She likes to go first so she can impress everyone. They're too proud to listen to advice. What he really wants is to force us out of the group. She's just too stubborn to admit she's wrong." Although these appraisals may be true on some occasions, in many cases they will be false. So is there ever a time that we can properly form a firm opinion about someone's motives? Yes, we may do so whenever the other person expressly admits to such motives, or when there's a pattern of incontrovertible facts that can lead to no other reasonable conclusion. But when such clear proof is not present, it is wrong to presume that we can look into others' hearts and judge the motives for their actions. Scripture teaches that God alone can see into the heart and discern a person's motives. When we believe that we're also able to do this, we're guilty of sinful presumption. All three types of critical judgments violate God's will. Scripture sternly warns against those who indulge evil suspicions about their brothers and fail to give them a chance to explain themselves. Our sin is compounded if we develop the habit of gossiping. Jonathan Edwards likens our believing and spreading a critical judgment to feeding on it as vultures do on flesh. That is what we're doing when we receive and circulate bad reports about others. It's like passing around rotting flesh. And so it's important that instead of gossiping when someone's stuck in sin, we go to them and correct. But as we do, we have to be careful first that we do it with the right attitude. We don't want to move from being a gossip to just being a critical person who goes around sharing our critical opinions with everyone. We want to be a charitable person who corrects charitably. And how do we do that? How have you worked on developing a charitable spirit towards others? What are some things that you have done to become more charitable? Are there particular people that you have struggled with being charitable towards? That's one way to become more charitable, is to notice patterns. There may be people that you can be so charitable towards. I know there's a group of people that I tend to be, I can go for so long with them. And then there's another particular group of people that I'm much quicker to be critical about. And so it's good to notice that pattern in yourself, because then you can be on the alert and seek to put off and put on. But how have you worked on becoming more charitable? Or what suggestions would you give?
So there was a time I was on a mission trip, and so much, so I was like getting to know this one guy, and all this stuff that this other guy was doing, it just seemed so wrong. And someone on the trip said, "When you're right, you're wrong."
Yeah.
And that has been so, that's like one of my most quoted things. It's not like always true, but as far as that thing in your heart where you're just like so incensed about all these wrong things and how right I am, how wrong the person is. And so that's like helped me so much.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're right, you're wrong.
Just like stop. What are some other ways you've worked on becoming more charitable? Yeah. 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 No, that's so helpful. Even just to give you a perspective on the person and how they're thinking, and well, that's good. Any other ways that you've worked on becoming more charitable? It's good even in your families maybe to have a stop. You know, like let's put off the habit of feeding on criticism of others, and let's try to think of 5 good things we can say about others. Even with your kids talking to each other, you want to be watching out for a critical spirit and helping them develop a charitable spirit towards one another in the way that they speak. And you want to get at what is in your heart that's causing you to be such a tough judge on this other person. asking questions. And what do you mean? Yes.
Is there something going on? Like,
yes.
Something, yeah. Just trying to clarify.
Yeah. Sometimes we can get very creative in imagining the worst in other people. So another way we can work on being charitable is by trying to get creative in imagining the best. Another way is to just, as you talk, especially with people that are close to you, ask them for help. Like, ask your wife, please help me, or your husband, please help me be charitable. Like, please help me. Sometimes a husband, wife, or brother can just egg each other on in critical spirit, especially towards certain people. And so you bring that person up, and all of a sudden, both of you are kind of off to the races. And one person says something critical, and then the other person's like, yeah, also this. And then the other person's like, yeah, did you think about this? And so you might say, hey, can we help each other, just quickly stop feeding on the worst possible motives or ideas or seeing what's wrong in others.